the one song that I remember from my childhood.
The first song that I remember.
My dad used to sing it.
The most important song.
I just love to play it over and over and over.
A strain of music, like a smell, can sometimes instantly bring up a piece of your past. Maybe some haunting feeling of a half-forgotten time and place. This is Hearing Voices from NPR. I'm Barrett Golding, and this hour, musical memory. You'll hear a few pieces from a couple series. One is Musicians in Their Own Words, produced by David Shulman. The other is by Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler. The series is called Song and Memory. They ask people, what one song from your childhood do you remember most? Here's Chef Anthony Bourdain's answer.
You know, so there I am, I'm 10 years old, I'm laying in bed at night, as you know, waiting to fall asleep as I did every night, listening to the cheap transistor radio on my headboard. You know, it's AM radio and a sea of sort of mediocre, industry-created pop.
Woke up this morning feeling fine.
You know, happy, poppy love songs. And suddenly, this beast of a song comes on. You listen to that organ, it catches you right away. Where are we? Some satanic roller rink? You can picture revenge fantasies to this music.
Come on, let me hear you cry now. That is big deal.
These guys were clearly dangerous.
That is day. Yeah.
Mom would not approve. Your mom would like the Beatles. Okay, they've got long hair, but they're nice boys. You know, question mark would rob the medicine cabinet while you're not looking, which made them immediately attractive to me. I wanted to be a bad kid. You know, I saw parental love as an obstacle to my having a good time. I envied all my friends who had divorced parents, you know, who were never there so they could go out and misbehave. I really resented the shackles of a fairly normal, happy American home. And this song connected with that. I think this song led directly to heroin for me. You know, this was definitely a gateway song for me.
Are you hung up?
You were, who you listened to, and what drugs you took.
Out of sight, yeah.
And all the people who I thought were really cool did heroin. You know, Charlie Parker, Keith Richards, you know, William Burroughs.
They all look like junk.
We're all dope fiends. So heroin is not what everybody else is doing. It's worse. And this song was not what everybody else is doing. It's worse and darker and a little scarier and menacing. So by the time I was 15, I'd figured out how to be bad. I'd figured out also that being the baddest kid in class was a way to get girls, and it was working for me.
You're a smart fella.
I always liked the bad girl in the cowboy movies. The dark-haired girl, the one who dies at the end for her sins, I always liked.
Would you know what kind of car this is?
I wanted the fast, you know, maybe slightly butch girl, you know, in the leather jacket, okay? Always the bad girl.
This is a stolen four-cylinder Ford coupe.
The more experienced girl, you know, the girl who, you know, would hide a gun for you. And I wanted to be the sort of person who she would find attractive.
You're good.
I ain't good. I'm the best.
I wanted to live out the sort of fantasies that I'd accumulated from watching movies and reading books. So I was already a longtime drug abuser and doing my very, very best to emulate the life and works of Hunter Thompson, who was my hero at the time.
Actually, we're both doctors of journalism, and we're on our way to Las Vegas to cover the main story of our generation.
I wanted to pack up a kit bag full of drugs and go off and get into completely insane, maximum drug-fueled experiences, which is exactly what I did. A friend and I decided to go away for the weekend to visit some friends who were playing at Kutcher's in the Catskills. You know, here I'm 15. And my friend Alfred is, I guess, 17 and driving on a learner's permit, his mom's car. We're on our way to visit our friends who were playing at Kutcher's. And we pick up two hitchhikers who are two strippers working at the motel across from the Concord. When we told them that, you know, we're high on drugs and have Quaaludes and other controlled substances, they said, oh, we'll come back later and party. And I lost my virginity in the Holiday Inn in Monticello, New York, to a 20-year-old exotic contortionist named Panama Red. At one point, she passed out on the Quaaludes, and we thought we'd killed her. Here we are. We're, you know, mom's car stolen. I'm standing in the motel, in this crappy motel room, and she's just taken two Paris 400 Quaaludes, which were sort of the Rolls Royce of methaqualone at the time. And mid-sentence, she sort of keeled over flat onto the shag carpet, and her little Yorkies running around barking at her. And I just remember the look of fear as I looked at my friend Alfred and thought, our parents think I'm sleeping over at your house, and I'm standing, like, you know, in a motel room with a dead stripper, and we've killed her with our illegal drugs. Fortunately, she revived. And I remember I couldn't tell the story. At a time when every day you did not lose your virginity was an endless sucking vortex of misery, agony, and embarrassment and shame, here was such an over-the-top story that no one would have ever believed it. Ever.
Too many teardrops for one heart to be crying.
There's a direct line from listening to this song to that dirty shag carpet and the stripper, exotic dancer, as she called herself.
You're way on top now.
I still love this song.
Since you left me.
It's pure, unfocused, sexual longing, rage, frustration with a beat.
Way down in me.
And that's what rock and roll's about.
But watch out now.
So all those people who said that rock and roll would make your kids rebellious, lead to teenage pregnancies and drug abuse, well, they were right.
And when the sun comes up, I'll be on top. You'll be right down there, looking up. And I might wave, come up here. But I don't see you waving now. I'm way down here, wondering how I'm gonna get you. But I know now, I'll just cry, cry. I'll just cry. Too many teardrops for one heart to be crying. Too many teardrops for one heart to carry on. You're gonna cry 96 tears. You're gonna cry 96 tears. You're gonna cry, 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 cry now. You're gonna cry, 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 cry 96 tears. Come on, let me hear you cry 96 tears. Woo! I wanna hear you cry night and day, yeah, all night long. A 96 tears.
June 2nd, 1958. That's when it was.
We have a difference on that. But she means when we got the license. Because 1955.
Is when we met.
Is when we embraced. Mm-hmm. All
so
the way.
We go by two different dates there.
And so I understand that's a woman's part of it. And there's certain laws. But I'm talking about the heart and the soul.
Well, now, you see, this is two different concepts. I have to get to know you and feel you and hear you and see you and being around you before I'm ready to embrace you.
Is that a tune? Can you sing it? I had a group at that time called the High Tones. And my saxophone player in that group was John Coltrane. I called the union. They said, well, we have a young lady down here that plays everything. Funerals, cocktail lounges. She coaches classical musicians. I said, well, I have to meet her. So we went and we wanted her to come try the organ. Well, her mother wouldn't let her come where the organ was. So we had to take the organ in South Philadelphia to her family's home. I think I had a little Jeep at that time. And yes. Take it in the house where this young lady would try it. I used to get down on the floor and hold her right foot because she was used to playing pipe organ where you play both feet on the organ and put it on the volume pedal and hold it there. So, you know, we have all kind of humor I smile and laugh because I've been tied in with this lady for 50 years. And so as a drummer, I'm on the edge of my seat because I never know which way she's going to go.
You can take a hymn and play it as it is in the hymn book. And then you can play that same piece of music so that it's jazz. But the whole omniance has changed. So it ain't the tune that you play, it's how you play it.
It's instant improvisation.
A lot of that. If it's a good night, you know, the men like to say that it's better than sex. What I feel is an accomplishment. What is it? Women are from what? Venus, Mars, and men are from the other one? I feel like an accomplishment has taken place, and I'm halfway pleased with myself and wish that as good as it felt, maybe next time it might even be better. The thing between Mr. C and myself, he pulls out all the stops, as it were, on his ears and his emotions and his foresight of just knowing me. And you'd be thinking
called
about one, and the phone might ring, and it's the other one on the other line.
It's about being housebroken, man.
It's about knowing each other and feeding each other air and spirit. He might do something on the snare, or he might do a cymbal thing. If I'm working out something on the keys, he's into the point where he can lead me in a direction that I'm trying to go. So when the two of us are playing, it's being husband and wife, it's being mother and father, it's being up and down, and it's everything rolled into one in your life when you come together to play music.
I'm just an old diehard that has loved music all my life. As a youngster, a mediocre violin player and a tap dancer and a singer and a drummer. And my biggest love is my partner, who is my queen. And sometimes she's so spiritual and plays so much, I said, well, he sent me an angel. And amen.
That was Trudy Pitts and Mr. C. a.k.a. Bill Carney, talking with David Shulman for the series Musicians in Their Own Words. Like so many great programs, it was funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You are hearing voices. Next up, musician Muhammad Nasio Ali from Ghana. He answers the musical question, what one song do you most remember from your childhood?
My most memorable song is called Chenchenbiedimewo, which is an Asante language, the tree language of Ghana. And it means someone has done me wrong. This song reminds me of my father, Alhaji Abubakar Ali III, who was the emir or the king of the Muslim community in Kumasi, Ghana. Usually my father would be playing the song in the morning. The speakers would be blaring out into the main compound. And the main compound is chaos. I mean, it's chaotic. Different people doing their chores in the morning, kids running around, goats all over the place, sheep, numerous people. Meanwhile, inside the living room, he's very pensive. So he would just be playing it and then thinking, pacing, doing his things, and just listening to this music. To the Western ear, it sounds like a very happy song. Like when you listen to this song, the beat sounds like a very, very happy, you can dance to it. But the lyrics, a servant has stepped on my foot, very, very sad, not knowing that I'm the servant of a very important king. Someone has wronged me. I'm sure when my father's listening to Chenchenbiedimewo, he's probably thinking about his political enemies and the wrong that they've done him.
There was an assassination attempt on my father once.
Someone has done wrong me.
It was at Friday at the mosque. And usually, being the spiritual leader of all the Muslims, my father always will have this statement, you know, at the end of Friday prayers. So he was out in the public, and a bunch of people just like attacked where he was. So this huge fight ensued, and a kid was stabbed. He died on the spot. But the target was my father. They were trying to kill him.
Someone has done wrong me. I believe I was also part of the reason why my father, when he listened to this song, he would be in a very pensive mood. Because being his first son, he was expecting me to do a lot.
Masanabo!
But then he made the mistake of sending me abroad to America to go to school.
Masanabo!
He was hoping I would study economics, political science, and come back home and be in politics. But I didn't want to inherit, I don't want to be a king, the burden, you know, of being a king. I don't want to take any burden. I was an artist.
Masanabo.
It's a musician.
Masanabo,
and I pretty much was in a self-imposed exile. For 10 years, I didn't go back home. Once he told me on the phone, he said, listen, I don't want to hear your lies anymore. You keep saying you're coming home today, you're coming home tomorrow. The only time I'll talk to you is when I see you physically, when I see you in Ghana. That really sent a message to me that, you know what, you gotta just go. I packed my bags and went to Africa. And it was just so beautiful. My father was so happy to see me back. And all my fears were just gone. But I guess with my father as well, he knew he was going to die. He just wanted me to come back. I left. 2 weeks later, he fell sick. And that was the end. He just wanted to see me to come back home.
Ann Hepperman and Carol Ola produced the series Song and Memory. More songs and memories coming up in a minute on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
The one song that I remember from my childhood.
The first song that I remember.
My dad used to sing it.
The most important song.
I just love to play over and over and over.
You are hearing voices, exploring song and memory.
I look at all the lovely people.
My name is Kelly Kinsey, and I'm from Monroe, Michigan. The one song that helped me get through a lot of sad times with my family was Eleanor Rigby by the Beatles.
Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream.
My house was very dysfunctional. My father was an alcoholic, and my brother was a manic depressant schizophrenic. With my brother's schizophrenia, it was so unreal and so bizarre. People would talk to him all the time through the TV, and at night he would be up talking to presidents.
Well, or ill.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Things would be crawling on him, and he would put it rollers in his hair and then just cut him out, and people would tell him to hurt himself and burn himself, and he jumped out of a second story window because, you know, he said he was told to do it.
All the lonely people, but do they all belong?
So the worse Robin got and the worse my dad got, the more I just retreated. My sister was really into music, and Saturday was cleaning day, and she'd play all this music, you know, Peter Frampton, James Taylor, and the Beatles, and I had heard the song Eleanor Rigby, and the words just gave me some comfort.
All the lonely people, where do they all come from?
When I played that song, I was very sure that the house was quiet. My mom would be waitressing, my dad would be at work, and my brother would be usually sleeping from being up all night, and I would put that song on, just that song, and play it maybe 10, 15 times.
All alone, all alone. Do they all, do they all.
my family looked normal. I mean, everything about our life was a secret. Each one of us could have sang that song, and it all would have been from the heart. But now we all realized how sad we are. I mean, if we could have just all came together and talked about it. But we never did. My life has changed so much since that time. I know I'm married. I got a wonderful husband and kids. So when it comes on the radio, I think a little bit about when I was 12. But it's not as sad because I've got so much happiness. But many times still inside, it's very scary for me. And I think that's the loneliness from the past.
Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people. Where do they all come from?
Hi everyone, we are now in New York City, downtown Manhattan, on the West 57th Street and 6th Avenue. We are on the 6th floor, and you hear the cars, the big trucks, and ambulance, motorcycles, and from here you can see the Great Carnegie Hall. So now we are going toward the window, and if you want to hear the really noise, listen. That's the rhythm of New York. Now I pull down. Better. Basically, it's like talking to play music. It's like, you know, you need to let people know what are you talking about. It's not like, I want to know somebody. This is unclear. Or you say, I want people to know something. Or, you know, sometimes if you phrase it's not right, it's like, I want people, and you know, it's like that. So music is totally language. For example, Brahms' A major intermezzo, for me, it's like someone telling a story for their children. Da-dee-da, da-dee-da, before they sleep. But then it totally changed. It's more like lovers. Maybe it's a lady say some sweet word to her boyfriend. So it's much more softer and much more intimate. Then you see Brahms start to having hope. More. Sure that after 20 years you are much more mature, have much more life experience, but it doesn't mean that you play better. You know, because once you have more knowledge, you're worried about this, you're worried about that, and then when you play, it's no fun. There's no always concerns, always like tricky stuff, and you never get out of it. And the music will make no color, no style. So that's why I think in the same time I must pay attention to always try to still play with freshness.
pianist Lung Lung talking to David Shulman of Musicians in Their Own Words. You are hearing voices in church.
Good morning.
One more from the series Song and Memory.
It got very cold after yesterday, didn't it?
Morning, troops.
My name is Ruth Shaver. I'm the pastor of the United Church of Christ in Shelbyburg, Pennsylvania.
See Pastor Ruth running up the aisle.
And the song that carries the most memory for me and the most meaning in my life is The Family of God. My father and I have been singing this song since I was 5 years old.
As you complete your pledge cards, we'll tell you a little bit more about the song that my father and I are going to sing at the offertory.
When we first started singing it, it was kind of a fluke thing. Dad was invited to sing, and he said, well, maybe Ruth will sing with us. I was 5 when we first sang it in church together, and I probably just barely 5. And we sang it once, and about probably 3 or 4 months later, we sang it again. And that launched our singing career together, if you will. When I was a year old, well, let me back up. My father went to Vietnam when I was 6 weeks old and didn't come home until I was almost 18 months old. And it took me a good time to warm up to him. But after that, we've been very closely bonded. And I think this song kind of cemented that. You know, I'm a daddy's girl. I make no bones about it. Of course, I look so much like my father that I couldn't be anything else like it. But there's a real sense that this is who we are, and that our love for each other is mirrored in the love that God has for each of his children.
In each victory in this family so dear.
I think the first time I heard the Gaithers sing this song was at a Gaither concert. And I just sang right along with it because I knew the words. So I don't know that the arrangement really affected me one way or the other. But this one I think I would sing if they put it to a rap beat. And in a sense, to me, those words are so powerful that if it took rap to get the point across, okay, go for it. I won't try it.
Brothers and sisters in Christ, baptism, we are initiated into Christ's holy church.
Well, as the pastor of the church, my primary responsibility is the Sunday morning worship service. And then during the week, I'm responsible for Bible study and for pastoral care needs, which includes visiting our shut-ins, doing hospital calls, and comforting in the moments when people are in pain. When I was here doing my interview in January, there was a parishioner in the church who had been very ill with cancer. And the chairman of the search committee that I was spending time with asked me on Thursday morning if I would mind paying a pastoral visit. He said, nobody's going to be offended if you say no, but we were wondering if you would. And I didn't hesitate. So we went by the house later that afternoon, and I went in, and I knew, just looking at him and listening to him, that he probably wasn't going to live through the weekend. His wife was there, and I just said a prayer with them. And I don't to this day remember what I prayed. I really don't, because what I do as a minister does not come from me. I'm just the vessel for God. It's very much a sense of watching myself. And it's very scary the first few times it happens. And sometimes it's still scary because sometimes things are going on and I'm not even fully aware of what it is that needs to be said. But God puts the words there. His widow has said to me more than once, you came in and you prayed with my husband, whom you had never met before, as though you had known him all his life. And that's a very powerful thing to be told as a minister. I mean, that's the power of God. Because if God truly knows us down to the number of hairs on our heads, then that was not me praying that prayer. That was God in the room with us. So when I came back in March, the first thing she did was throw her arms around me and say, thank you. And she did that very publicly. Those people who hadn't yet met me, that was a sign, this person is part of our family.
Praise God.
think by having that family atmosphere, we're a lot more tolerant of each other. Let's face it, when you put Lutherans and Presbyterians and Evangelical and Reformed and Methodists together in a church, there needs to be a lot of room for grace and forgiveness and understanding. But we are Christians, and we're all called to be Christians together. And whatever our other label is, we're Christians. And we unite under that particular banner within the family of God.
Redemption Song, that song written by Bob Marley, is a man talking about the struggle of a displaced people coming from another continent against their will, which is really the story of the African-American experience. He addresses it with this beautiful melody and talks about this one thing that Bob always was doing in his music, saying, "Everything gonna be all right." So when he's singing this terrible reminder about what happened, he's also saying, redemption. There's gonna be a redemption. It's gonna be a redeeming. It's not revenge. It's not about violence or hostility. It's gonna be a sense of, like, we're here for a greater purpose than to moan and groan. We're here to see the joy of life. And if you look to your Creator, you will find another level of resolution. And that's where the great redemption comes from. So that song is almost like a hymn.
Old pirates, yes, they rabbi. Sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs.
Bob Marley and the Wailers. Before that, pianist Monty Alexander talking about Marley's redemption song. You are hearing voices. And sometimes when I'm hearing voices, the radio's on. It's NPR, and I am transfixed. That's what happened when I heard an interview by Melissa Block of All Things Considered. It was 1 year after the 2008 earthquake in China.
And today we'll hear the voices of children who lived through the earthquake here last May. These are excerpts from the interviews that we had with all the children, where we asked them, what did the earthquake sound like? And separately, none of them listening to each other's interviews, all made this sound, sort of like a whole. That's folk musician Abigail Washburn talking about her new project, a benefit album called Afterquake. Washburn and electronic artist Dave Leong recorded the children, their songs, poems, and games, and set them to music in a kind of post-quake soundscape. Washburn used to live in Sichuan as an exchange student, and after the earthquake, she and Dave Leong came back. She brought her banjo, and she played at temporary schools set up for children who'd lost their homes. The kids have been relocated, often hours away from their parents.
After I would perform, I'd have these students come up to me and want to share their songs with me. And a lot of times they would share their stories, too. And they were very, there were many very emotional moments where girls would sit on my lap and start crying and saying, 我不自信, I don't believe in myself. I don't know how to believe in myself anymore. I don't trust the world. I don't trust life. I was shook to the core by that.
What did you say to that?
I said, 应该自信吧, you've got to believe in yourself. When you're down, sing, you know, your voice is so beautiful, you should sing. It'll make you feel better. And that's where it kind of left off.
Let's listen to one of these songs. This is called Song for Mama, and this includes sound of people rebuilding their home.
So what you hear at first is brick laying, and then you hear a cement mixer come in. And that's the sound of a wheelbarrow that actually carries the bricks and also some of the gravel.
And we're hearing a woman speaking here.
Yeah, that's the mother of this boy that we met. Named Chen Hongling. He and all of his classmates were relocated to Emeisan, which is, I guess, 4 to 6 hours away, and they don't see their parents on a regular basis anymore. So that was the sound of his mother speaking, and she was saying, you have to study hard. Whatever you do, mother and father will always support you.
Hmm.
And he's sort of repaying this with a very emotional dedication to his mother.
What's the son singing in the song to his mother here, Abigail?
At first he's singing Moon. He's singing to the moon. Moon, I give you my heart's longing. You know, it's my missing of my mother. For you to then give to her, because we're so far away. Mom, your child misses you so much. And she's saying, Hongli, I'll always support you. I'm always going to support you.
It was just a really moving song, purely a cappella when he sang it for us, so we went and visited his family in Wenchuan. There was a really poignant scene when Abby took out her laptop and actually played the a cappella of her son singing the song, which is dedicated to her, to the mother, and she just broke down in tears, and she had these headphones on, and it was a very surreal scene, and it, I think, reminded us of how powerful this music could be.
There are beautiful photographs that are on your website that show these girls at these relocation schools washing their laundry out of plastic buckets, and their toothbrushes are all lined up, and they're sitting on bunk beds. It looks like a happy place, and I'm sure it isn't always by any stretch. But there's one song here which includes, I guess, a poem from one of the students at one of these schools, and you call it Dream Seek. Tell us about that one.
The poem was written by a young girl named Luo Hongmei. And she wrote this in response to the earthquake. And this is actually just an excerpt of a much longer poem. We took the first portion of it from this poem called 追逐, 梦想, which means chasing the dream. 梦想的大门, the door to my dream slowly opens. 梦想的花朵, the bloom of my dream slowly 梦想, unfolds. Dream, I slowly, slowly come to you. I can't
I can't wander from you. I will forever follow after you.
Had a lot of the students at these schools lost friends, lost family members in the earthquake?
Oh, yes. This particular relocation school took kids from Shui Mo, which is a certain part of Wenchuan County. They luckily weren't in the epicenter of the earthquake, so not everyone lost someone. But three of them lost direct relatives, and during our interviews with them, they clearly showed their grief and their continued grief. And one girl said, "I just don't know how to feel comfortable in the world anymore because the people I shared my life with have gone."
You know, it's interesting. When we interviewed them, there were obviously a lot of stories of loss and separation that obviously are just uncomfortable for any human being. But I think what both Abby and I did not anticipate was that from, I guess, the darkest depths, these children were actually able to find so much happiness, especially in this school at Ome San. It was just an amazing communal experience, and I think the earthquake definitely brought them all so much closer together. And we saw so much joy, and obviously half of the record is just very uplifting, and they were some of the happiest kids, to be honest, that I think I've ever seen, and it was just very, very reassuring to both Abby and myself.
It was. It was really surprising. We thought we were going to go into the heart of this and find out that grief was the thing we needed to work through. And although a portion of it absolutely is, the bulk of what we found was children rebuilding their lives and living to the best they could and taking advantage of everything they had around them to make that possible. There was a lot of hope, so much hope.
Well, let's end on one of the most uplifting pieces here that you've done. This is two sisters from one of the Tibetan areas of Sichuan, and there's just incredible lyricism and sweetness in this song.
Well, you would never know it, but this was actually the response to Dave and I asking the group, "Hey, what did your parents sing to you at night? You know, is there a lullaby or something?" And these girls step up and they just jump into this, like, jam and rap. We're like, this is awesome.
Tibetan rap. Well, Abigail Washburn and Dave Leong, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having us, Melissa.
Thanks very much.
Proceeds from the album Afterquake go to Sichuan Quake Relief. The musicians are Abigail Washburn, David Liang of the Shanghai Restoration Project, and children in the Sichuan province. I'm Barrett Golding, coming to you from Peak Recording in Bozeman, Montana. Links to the Afterquake Project and everything else you heard in the hour are at hearingvoices.com. Oh.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.